Okay, we're ready to go.
Okay, good. Well, welcome to everybody, particularly old and new that I've met before or just meeting up with. So yeah, we're starting again probably for 4 weeks, then have a break, and then might do another three or four after that. And I've chosen a slightly different format, certainly for a couple of them, and then we can sort of see whether we want to do more like that. And the format is that for the first, so we say 25 minutes, half an hour at the most, I'm going to talk about a particular book of the Bible, and then I'm going to shut up for half an hour while you read it. So the middle half, no, it's not the middle half, it's the middle third will be you reading it. If there's more than one of you in the room, then you can read it to each other. And then in the last third, from sort of 8 o'clock onwards, we'll come back and discuss it and see if there's any questions and so on. So there's no PowerPoint, there's no screen sharing. It's just me rabbiting on for about 25 minutes, opening up and introducing a particular book or part of a book. If the book's really long, then we'll have to restrict ourselves to part of it. But tonight's book is not a long one. It's not short, but it's just about the right size. And so this evening, you are going to read the book of Ecclesiastes. At this point, I wait to see who switches off and goes and finds something to
Very
do. But if you want to find the book of Ecclesiastes, it's somewhere in the middle. Have that ready. And I do suggest that you take some notes, okay? Because some of the things that I'm going to suggest will be hints to look out for, questions to consider, and that will inform not only your reading, but any discussion afterwards, okay? So why have I picked this book? Well, perhaps because it's one that isn't always read very much, or certainly very easily. It can be seen as one of the most puzzling books in the Bible, with its tendency to depress rather than inspire. And in fact, it could be asked whether or not it really should be in God's Word at all, and why should we bother to spend time with it. Some people have almost relegated it to the category of a dangerous book. That it seems to be contradictory to other parts of scriptures. It seems to promote despair, fatalism. It's got a controversy about it, therefore. And yet it's there, and it's there as part of the wisdom section of the Old Testament. What wisdom means, in the sort of tradition of Hebrew scriptures, is it means learning how to live successfully, learning how to live well. And that means effectively learn to live in the way that God approves of. So it's skills for living, if you like. And as you work your way through this book, that'll be one of the things that I want you to keep looking out for. How does this help me to live better? It's meant to have a practical aspect as well. But it is so extraordinary that it's one of the last books that was admitted to the canon, largely due to the influence of a famous rabbi called Akiva. If you've heard of Rabbi Akiva, he was the one who argued for its inclusion. He was also responsible for getting the Song of Songs into the canon. So it looks like he had a wide taste when it came to literature. It's also the book that's read at a particular feast. All the feasts have a book attached to them, and the book of Ecclesiastes is read at the Feast of Tabernacles. And perhaps the reason for that is that the time of Tabernacles is the time of great joy, celebration, rejoicing, and so it's balanced up with a book whose mood is rather different. You could say full of gloom, full of futility, frustration, and so on. So it's always worth having a sort of balanced view of different aspects of life. Now, it's usually regarded as having been written by Solomon. And I'm going to point out how that is probably unlikely, although if you want to consider it by him, that's sort of fine. But the opening, as always in a book like this, is a good understanding of who it's by. And the opening just says the words of the teacher. And the teacher, that word that's used as teacher in Hebrew, is Kohelet, which I'll spell as it's Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. Kohelet. Q-O-H-E-L-E-T-H. So that's the best way of thinking about this writer, this author of the book. Whether or not he is Solomon, I'll say a bit more about in a moment, but the name means, and you might have got a footnote to help you, it comes from the word Kahal, Q-A-H-A-L, which just means an assembly of people, a community. And the Kohelet himself is the one who calls this assembly together. He was the assembler. But he was doing it for a purpose, and that purpose was to teach or to share aspects of God's wisdom for their mutual benefit and for their sort of edification. So whoever he really is, it's his role that's perhaps more important than any sort of title. It's what his function was, which was to teach people who he had gathered together in order to make them more successful and wise in living. We call it Ecclesiastes. That's come out of the word ecclesia, which also roughly means to gather together and so on. Now, rabbinic tradition did ascribe this book to Solomon. They liked the idea that Solomon was very active in writing lots of things, like the Proverbs, the Song of Songs, and therefore Ecclesiastes as well. And the opening statement may hint at him, because it says the words of the teacher, son of David, king of Jerusalem. But his name is never used. And that doesn't really prove anything, because the word son doesn't necessarily mean the next one down. The word son means any descendant, because there's no word for grandson, great-grandson, and so on. So perhaps he was a descendant of David in some way. And then it says king of Jerusalem. But now we're going to find a bit of a problem with that particular statement, as I'll explain in a minute. But firstly, the style of Hebrew is actually later than the time of Solomon. So in some ways, it doesn't read as though it's by him in the same sort of way. And if you look at chapter 1 and verse 12, when he gives a little bit more detail about himself, he says, I, the teacher, I, Kohelet, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. Not I am king, but I was king. But of course, Solomon could never look back and say, I was king, because like all the kings, they just, once they began, they continued as king. They die as king. And it actually says also in verse 16 of chapter 1, look, I have grown and increased in wisdom more than anyone who has ruled over Jerusalem before me, more than all who have reigned over him, over Jerusalem before him. Not the, because if he was Solomon, there'd only be one before him, that would be David. So it does look as though this is someone from a later period who is looking back, and he's sort of using Solomon as a bit of a model, perhaps, as we'll see through the things that he says, but he isn't actually any particular king. I think he's playing a sort of game with us, or at least I don't mean he's trying to fool us in any way. But what he's actually doing is he's saying, let's put ourselves in the position of the most famous person we know of, someone who was powerful, who was rich, who had everything he could possibly want, who was king, had all the power, He had so much wealth, so much wisdom, and so on. Who might we think of? Oh, let's think of Solomon. Let's put ourselves in his shoes. Let's play a game of, let's imagine that you were that person. It's a bit like sort of having a fantasy of, if I was king for the day, then wouldn't it be wonderful? And actually, his conclusion at the end of it all is that even if you are as brilliant as Solomon, as favoured as Solomon, and so on, life ends up still being meaningless. That's his catchphrase, if you like. You might remember the old version that says, vanity of vanity, vanity of vanities, just meaning emptiness. Someone has described that word a bit like trying to describe a soap bubble, which looks nice for a while, pretty colourful, floating around, suddenly pop, it's gone, it was empty, and there's absolutely nothing left at the end of it. So whoever he was, whenever he lived, he chose to write as though we were in the same sort of status as Solomon, and examine life from that perspective and see if we come to any sort of conclusion, see if we agree with his conclusion, which is that at the end of it, when all's said and done, when all's come and gone, it was still pretty meaningless, which is why you might think he was the most sort of pessimistic guy. He was certainly an older man, and we'll find later on, particularly he mentions himself again in chapter 12, that he wants to give advice to the young people while they are still young. He also is described as a wise man. He has thought a lot. He's reflected a lot. He's asked the big questions of life, and he's come to certain conclusions. And those conclusions seem very negative and very restrictive. And really, he's challenging us to go with him on this intellectual journey, this journey of exploration of life, and see if we want to end up in the same sort of place as him, same conclusion as him. So I'm going to give you two phrases to look out for. He repeats certain phrases a lot. And these two phrases help us understand his worldview and the conclusions he comes to. So about 28 times, although I haven't counted them, and I don't suggest you spend the time counting them either, he refers to, or uses the phrase, under the sun. You may remember the most famous one is, there's nothing new under the sun. What does he mean by that? Well, under the sun is a phrase for everywhere that the sun shines its light, which basically is this world, this life, everything on earth. So every time he uses the phrase under the sun, he is restricting himself to this physical world only. He cannot conceive of another world to come. And he also uses the phrase, all the days of my life. So he's thinking only within the restriction of his lifetime. He can't understand any life to come or any world to come. So in other words, if all you see and all you can think about is what's in this world and in this time when you're alive, this is how you will conclude life is like. So he's giving us a very restricted, constrained sort of philosophy within which to work. Now, whether he personally has that, or whether he's, as I say, playing this game with us, like, just suppose, and this is how you think, then this is the conclusion that you would come to. He is, after all, primarily, more than anything else, a teacher. He is a mentor. He's someone who's going to take us on a thought journey. In fact, as well as being a mentor, you could say he's a tormentor, because he actually does put us through it a bit in our mental thinking on all this. But at least that's his point. He wants us to think things through and understand that those two restraints inevitably lead us to thinking that at the end of the day, it's all been a waste of time. Now, I'm going to give you I've given you a couple of things to look out for. I'm going to give you a bit of an outline of the book, a sort of structure. So as you read it, look out for this or these. So this, again, is something you might want to write down. The first two chapters hold together. So if you want to say the first section is simply chapters 1 and 2. The first 11 verses acts as a sort of introduction, an introduction where he states his conclusion at the beginning. Okay, is life worth living? Okay, here's the bad news to start with. And then he gets into his, let's suppose you were king, let's see what life gives you if you were the most privileged man you could think of, and ask what your achievements would be like. So that's the first two chapters. That's the opening section. The next one begins with one of the most common chapters in the whole Bible, really, chapter 3. If anyone knows anything from Ecclesiastes, it is there is a time for this, there's a time for that, and so on. I'll leave you to decide whether he's describing something good about time or something bad about it. Some people have simply said, this is the tapestry of time. It's the way life ebbs and flows. Others talk about the tyranny of time. It's sort of got its hold on us in this way. Again, it probably depends what kind of worldview you have as to whether you think there's positive or negative in here. And I warn you that this section that goes on to somewhere around the end of chapter 6, you read chapters 3, 4, 5, and 6, this is the most depressing part of the book. You're going to read lots of things here about suffering, corruption, injustice, oppression, and so on. So by the time we've got halfway through, he's really sort of depressed us thoroughly. But that's okay, because he hasn't finished. But whether we come out the other side or not will depend upon how we tackle the questions that he asks. Chapter 7 starts off with examples of wisdom. In other words, you get a collection of proverbs. So you get, from chapter 7 onwards, a whole series of proverbs. But it's not long before you're back into cynicism, uncertainty, doubt, and despair, all the way through to chapter 9. When you get to chapter 9 and verse 13, chapter 9, verse 13, there's a little parable, and then from verse 17 onwards, there's a lot more proverbs. So he's now giving us lots of different bits of wisdom to think about. And towards the end, he does try and sum things up. He does say, never mind about how despairing the whole thing is, enjoy life while you can. And he will give you some positive advice. But it's also still within the restrictions of this world and this life. See, basically, when you've read this book, at the end, you're thinking, I can't wait to move into the New Testament. That's us as Christians. But there must be a bigger answer than all this. And yes, there is. And we'll talk about that after you've read the book. So it's a very good book to put out there for people who are sort of worldly people, for them to be told what it's really like, so they might ask for something bigger and better, and then there's a chance to talk about what God has done. So that's the sort of structure of it. Did that go a bit too quick? Have you made a note of some of these sections? But
not too quick.
Sorry, say it again.
Not too quick, no.
It wasn't too quick, okay. No. But in some ways, you find your own way through it when you're reading it. I'm only giving you some kind of outline. Can I suggest also you look out for little summary statements? He might suddenly say, and so this, or then this, or for this. So there are certain times at the end of these sections when he gives you a little summary of where we've got to so far. And I could leave you with one big question to try and work your way through. When you're thinking about this guy, ask yourself, is he a pessimist? Is he a realist? Or is he just confused? In other words, does he actually know what he's talking about at all? He's actually being really clever, though, and he knows how to put together a case, an argument. But is he being pessimistic? Deliberately so? Is this really his worldview? Or is he actually being realistic, and therefore he's picking up the realism of life in order to get his message across? Now, because he is he's Jewish, whether he's Solomon or not, he is Jewish, he ought to have a sort of worldview which is, should we say, more in line with God than he's portraying. So maybe, as I say, he is giving us a different perspective on things to help us see where that particularly leads to. So is he confused? Is he a pessimist? Is he realist? How is he helping people to discover how they are actually thinking? He wants us to examine our own thought processes, really, and help us to come to what ultimately is the right sort of belief that we should have. He does end up with a final summation. The end of the matter is this: fear God and keep his commandments. If that's the only positive thing you get out of it, well, at least that's something. You may not understand everything. You may still think that life is pretty awful at times, but stand in awe of God and obey him, and at least you'll get through life successfully. You'll have learned something of wisdom. But of course, he's not against having some fun along the way. He's just making us realise that life ultimately is more futile and frustrating if all you're aiming for is to have a good time. Where is the profitability in all this? Where is the profit? Jesus asked, what does it profit a man to gain the whole world but lose his life? I think that's the big question that he's asking of Ecclesiastes. Koheleth is asking us here. Okay, if you gain the whole world, you can be a Solomon-type figure, got everything you want, the end of it, when your life is gone, would you count it as profit or loss? Gain or loss? What reward is there? Right, so at this point, unless there's a desperately important question or comment, I'm going to leave you to read through the book, and then we'll pick up some of these points later on. Does anyone want to ask anything before I say farewell for half an hour? Okay, has that got you at least intrigued into reading it?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay.
Right, and I'd suggest I'm going to switch off the recording now.
Yeah. It's always Steve what he does with it anyway.
Yeah, so, it's recording.
Now, if you want to send a message through with a question or a comment, you can use the chat facility. And if Christine or somebody, Nigel, but Christine mainly can have a look and see what's there.
Yep.
So we don't miss anything. But did you enjoy his little game with you? Did you enjoy the mental game he went through with you? And what do you think of him? Where do you want to start? Any questions, any comments?
I'm glad you gave us the introduction, Paul, because it helped to get a different perspective on it than we might have had before.
Yeah. With an unusual book, particularly a very Hebraic one and a particular, very specific, specialist sort of genre, it isn't easy just to sit down today and read it through without thinking, why is it there? What's it all about? So we need some guidelines on that. But you must still have got questions or big comments of some kind.
I enjoyed reading it through. It's Crystal here, and yes. It's made me smile actually. In chapter one, I thought, for those who are vehement sort of man-made climate changer people, that sort of verse 3 down to verse 9.
Yeah.
You know, the earth remains forever. So those who are saying that the earth is going to disappear or be done with in about 12 years' time.
Okay. Well, it's going to disappear one day when Jesus comes back and God wraps all things up. But
that's right. That's right.
But mainly, you're right. There's a sort of cyclical nature to the whole of nature here. He's observed nature,
yeah,
and noticed that the sun goes round in big cycles,
yeah,
and the wind does, and the rain and the and everything does. The streams do. I love the bit about the streams flow into the sea, but the sea is never full.
Yes.
Yeah. Possibly, if you think about it. What happens then? Oh, it gets evaporated up and down, comes back down again. And he's sort of using that to say, well, that's how our thinking can be and how life can appear, just one cycle after another. And that's his idea behind there's nothing new under the sun.
Yes, that's exactly right. Which is another, because he says that several times, does he, like you pointed out. We're chasing after the wind, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. And whatever we're experiencing right now today in the earth, there's nothing new under the sun. There's a massive, tremendous comfort, isn't there, in that?
Mm-hmm.
Because God holds all things. So yeah. We don't have to worry.
As long as we can see that.
Yeah.
But he's speaking to those who don't necessarily have that particular.
Absolutely.
Thing. And therefore, it's a good understanding of how their minds work. So, yeah. Anything else?
I thought it was very, very Jewish on the one hand and on the other hand.
Yes, good. Yes. Again, I think that's part of his clever teaching style, to be honest. Coming back to this idea, is he confused? Because he does seem to sort of vacillate a lot. Deep despair, and then little glimpses of faith, and so on. So is he really just sort of not sure himself? But I actually think that it's part of a teaching style, that he leads you down one particular path, and then he says, but mainly, have you thought about this as well? And it's all part of his style, if you like. Did you like his honesty?
I thought can you hear me, Paul?
Yeah, I can now, Adam.
Yeah. All right, thank you. I thought that the actual book is extremely profound,
yeah,
and it's very sensible as to what we know today and what's been known all the time.
Yeah.
But I get the question coming up, that did the teacher know Jesus?
Yeah, well, the answer, of course, is no, isn't it?
Yes, and I think what you read here is a warning to understand God. You know, more than understand this life. We're all, if you like, fallen people. And the devil has a real game with us, and he can play us like a fiddle. And therefore, there are things which must be profound, come from God. And it's only through Jesus can you escape this. You may indulge in this, but Jesus paid the price for it, that we go scot-free. And I think that's the big message.
It is. That's the conclusion, but you can't get it completely from Ecclesiastes, because when I answered your question, does he know Jesus? No, that's simply because he's under the Old Covenant. Now, of course, he knew God. He knew God in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
And therefore, he's got these glimpses of how you can, one, enjoy life now, but not all bad. And it certainly isn't all God's fault that it's like this. It's man's fault. But equally, you have to look beyond the immediate and so on. But towards the end, I will pick up this point and talk about how Jesus changes this whole worldview completely. Yeah. So, but yes, that this is a message for our non-Christian friends.
Yeah.
Life is in this kind of cycle of pessimism and... even when they don't always realise it, occasionally it's like the roundabout stops and you get off and you think, well, what was that about?
Yeah.
As I say, he's very honest. He recognises that life does ebb and flow. There's a lot of, however godly you are, sometimes things are going to go wrong. But I don't think he's a pessimist in the usual sort of proper definition of it, which is the belief that this is the worst of all possible worlds and everything naturally tends towards evil and despair and so on. He recognises there's a problem in the world, but not because God has fixed all fates in such a way that it has to be like that.
So there's a real plea to young people, isn't there, as well, to say, you know, I can see these things. I'm the older one. I'm the one with wisdom. All these things, all these shiny things that you'll go after, you know, some of them will seem really nice and they may seem pleasurable, but actually at the end of the day, bring you nothing. So it's almost like he wants to save young people going through all of that.
Indeed, and that's why he clearly is an older person. Chapter 12 is, remember your creator in the days of your youth before you end up like I am.
Yes.
Wisdom is usually the privilege of the gray hair, shall we say.
Wouldn't we say the same to young people? You know, wouldn't we, when we're with young people, isn't our heart's plea to warn them about things and to hope that they'll listen because we want to see them saved from some of the heartache and... Even though we know trials will come to all of us, but you know.
But it is very difficult to make them listen or realise. Now, whether the way the world is going, it will jolt more people, younger people, out of this kind of life's just here to be enjoyed and never worry about the end of it all. But someone has said that life is lived forwards, but it's understood backwards. In other words, you don't get to that full understanding of it until you've got towards the end.
Yeah. Paul,
someone else is trying to come in. Sorry, who else is now?
Nick, you want the word?
Yeah. Just looking at the whole book, so there are so many ideas. It jumps
from
one idea to another. It's always jumping about.
Indeed.
It's not really, sometimes it's not connected.
True.
It's a jumble of thoughts.
It is.
And it reminded me of somebody who'd had a lifetime of counselling. And I know you were saying earlier that this is not Solomon, but it reminded me of somebody that had gone through a lifetime of hearing other people's problems, being a counsellor.
Yes.
Yeah. Had heard just day after day after day, people coming to, you know, with their woes. And like he's seen it all. And it's just all just coming out, and he's seen the futility of so many different situations, relationship situations, the wealth, the yearning after things. It's almost like a lifetime of counselling different people, but seeing repetition as well.
Yeah, absolutely right. The book has been described as a sort of patchwork affair. So although there's sections of it, it's not necessarily one thing. But towards the end, when he says, not only was the teacher wise and he imparted knowledge, he pondered and searched out and set in order the proverbs, searched to find just the right words, so that what he wrote was upright and true. So he had a lot of things to draw on, and then he started to try and put it down in a proper way for people.
Where's that, Paul, that bit you just quoted?
Towards chapter 12. Verse 9 onwards.
Because I think my observation is that it does read to me very much like some things that Solomon has written. And I wondered, whether Solomon had written a lot of it and someone gathered it all together and kind of stitched it together. And put it
Well, yes, some of it may have been left behind by Solomon. But and in some ways, it might have been how Solomon felt by the very end. But as I say, going on the base, rabbinic tradition has attached it to Solomon, and we sort of followed that, mainly because it just says the son of David, king of Jerusalem, without realizing a saint doesn't have to be his direct son, and it could be a later person who is looking back. Yes, maybe using some of Solomon's proverbs and other thoughts. Yeah, I don't rule that out.
There are other strong reasons for thinking that it is Solomon. I don't think it's quite as one-sided the argument of the authorship as you've painted.
Right, go on then.
I've got an introduction to the book which says that there are the reasons that you gave, but also that there are other references that it points to, chapter 2, verses 7 and 9. Says the author identifies himself as one who has gathered and arranged many proverbs. That's the bit that you were just quoting, 12:9.
Yes.
No other writer in this class has been identified from the Old Testament period. Yeah, that's really, I think, maybe what Monica was.
But you could still be putting yourself in someone else's shoes and writing it like that. I mean, I undertook great projects. Yes, these are the things that Solomon did. But it could be, I mean, you probably know that in the past, certain books were written in that sort of style. You didn't have to sort of identify yourself and make it your own sort of copyrighted thing. So he may be drawing upon the life of Solomon and writing it up as using reality.
Yeah. But and maybe he's, you know, drawing upon excerpts or fragments.
Oh, absolutely, there might be. Yeah. What I'm going to say at the end, which means I'll say it now, even though it's not the end, but it's always good to bring in a conclusion early. In the end, we meet this guy only through his writing, or what he has left us as in written form. So we're never going to know completely who he was, or even what his own views necessarily were. We've only got this written piece to try and explore. It's open to interpretation in various ways, although the main message remains sort of strong and clear. But we don't know if he believes all he says or if he's just raising questions for debate. Is the confusion actually his, or is he explaining how this kind of thinking leads to conclusion, at least to confusion, and so on? A gifted teacher will always try and identify with other people and talk their language, and maybe in a skillful way lead them to make logical conclusions in order to undermine them and then transform their thinking in a different way. So, as I say, we never meet him, we only meet him through his writings as such. But I think with what we said, we would agree that it's very appropriate for today's postmodern society and its existential sort of thinking and ideology, and the need for a greater wisdom from above.
I thought chapter 7 up to 8 verse 1 was very like Solomon.
Yeah.
I wondered if actually that was from Solomon or from a disciple of Solomon.
Well, yes. And of course, in the book of Proverbs, there are proverbs by other people besides Solomon. Mm. So he wasn't the only proverb writer. But yes, indeed, it's quite possible. I mean, did you like some of this wisdom in chapter 7, that the day of death is better than the day of birth?
Yes.
Yeah. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to a house of feasting. Mm. It's better to go to a funeral than a birthday party. And why do you think that is? Makes you think about life more. And where it's ending. Yeah. So, sorrow is better than laughter. Sad face is good for the heart. Now, of course, he's not going to say in the end, every day has to be like that. But he's saying that you need that perspective thing. Where's the bit about, is it in this chapter where he says, it might even have been better to have been stillborn than to...
Yeah.
Might be in the later bits. You know, was it even worth coming alive at all? Oh, yes, I've got here chapter 4. I declared that the dead who had already died are happier than the living who are still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been, who has not seen the evil that is done under the sun. Well, I wouldn't want that as my fundamental philosophy of life, but you know, you can see where he's coming from. And he's being honest about it, and you know, he then sort of leaves you to work out, oh yes, I sometimes feel like that, or golly, how do I get out of that kind of thinking? That's what he wants us to do. He wants us to examine ourselves and say in the end, is this it?
If we examine ourselves, Paul, and decide that we're on the wrong side of it, is there anything we can do in our own power to get out of it?
Ah, well, no, that's why in this stage, within the period of time where he was, his conclusions are also fairly limited.
That's right.
You know, fear God and obey his commandments. You know, this is the safe way, and that's fine. It is what I think. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. Yeah. I mean, that's so important, because how many people today, particularly young people, even believe there is a Creator?
Absolutely.
They've fallen away from that idea.
When I read this, Paul, sorry to interrupt you, when I read this, I could understand it and I could reason with it from my own experience. But if I talk to my grandson, who's 17 and just bought his first car and dresses in all, it means nothing, does it? You know, that this is, today is what it means to young people, you know. Where they are, what's happening today,
Yes. Yeah, why should we remember our Creator, even if we think there is one at all? We want to get on with life and do what we think. Now, of course, we are in a better position today because we do have the gospel and we do...
Absolutely.
And we have more of the Holy Spirit than they had then, or at least in a different way.
I find it quite encouraging, Malcolm, to realise that it's been like that for 3,000 years with me or grandchildren.
Absolutely. But I think it may be getting a little bit worse.
So there is nothing new under the sun.
There is nothing new under the sun.
And actually, this writer says, don't do that. Don't look back and say, oh, why was it so much better in the olden days?
Yes. Is there something you want to ask, Crystal? I see you've got a hand-up signal.
Hey, that's good, isn't it? I don't know how to put my picture up now. It's just like a grey background with a camera in the middle and a line through it, but I don't know how to unstop it.
No, somewhere in your symbols down, maybe down the bottom of your screen, you've got a start video button.
I've got it. It's on stop at the moment. It says stop.
Right, click on it.
Yeah, and then it says start.
It's not working.
With a line through it.
Yeah, never mind. Perhaps
it's don't something worry about to it tonight.
Investigate afterwards and at the end, perhaps, and get a bit more technical help from someone who knows. But I'm glad you're wanting us to see you now, so you reckon you're a bit more presentable.
Yes, I'm decent.
Sorry, that shouldn't go on the recording. I don't know how you get around that one. But to come back, this is the main point, and we'll look at some other texts in a minute, if you like. The New Testament does help us to resolve all of these issues, all of these questions that he poses, because in the New Testament, Jesus is the wisdom of God. Remember, this is a wisdom book. You're coming to the New Testament, and you meet a new kind of wisdom, person, the person of Jesus, who came from beyond the sun and who lives beyond just the days of this life, resurrection. So that's what makes all the difference. It's in him that we find all the answers to the particular questions that he's raising. So he's not going to have the full answer until we come to a point in history where God himself has stepped in and brought new wisdom from beyond the sun and from beyond the grave. Can I draw your attention to some other verses? Have a look. You know these anyway, but it fits in. Ephesians 4:17. 17. Now, I think it's using Gentiles here to mean non-believers. Sometimes it's translated. But I think Paul also uses this elsewhere. So I've said Ephesians 4:17. Have I got this right? You must no longer live as the Gentiles do. That's really the unbelieving Gentiles. In the futility of their thinking. The futility of their thinking. Maybe clever, maybe smart. Maybe be able to do lots of clever things. But it's futile. They are darkened in their understanding and separated from the life of God because of the ignorance that is in them due to the hardening of their hearts. And it goes on again, doesn't it, that in other places, that until we come to Christ, our thinking is largely darkened. It goes around in these futile things. Do you remember Romans 8, towards the end of Romans 8? Paul again picking up this idea about the whole of creation groaning in frustration, in the futility of it all, because it's awaiting something. So Romans 8, and it's verses 18 to 20, I think this is not, it's not the very end of the chapter. So it's really 19 and 20, Romans 8, 19 and 20. The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. In other words, for salvation to be fully manifest. For the creation was subject to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. Now, what that lengthy sort of sentence is really saying is that once we fell, once man lives in disobedience to God, God has made sure that creation by itself can never be fully satisfying. There is a level of innate frustration now within creation so that you cannot live apart from God and enjoy his world as fully as he intended it. It's impossible to do. And that's almost what Coeth has been fumbling around with, saying, I know there's lots of good stuff here, I just can't quite get to grips with it all. And that's because he hasn't understood that creation has been made and subjected, that's the fallen creation, to a frustration so that it cannot be fully satisfying until it's brought into the glorious freedom of the children of God. In other words, until humanity has been saved and remade, and there's a new humanity, then you can get a new heaven and a new earth and a new creation that will never experience that frustration again. So part of what we see in the world around us, we could say, is the frustration of a fallen creation, whether it's in fire, flood, pestilence, hail, volcanoes or whatever. This is all the world objecting to man's sinfulness and just longing and waiting for the day when we are all recreated in Christ.
So to summarise Ecclesiastes is do the best you can with what you've got.
There's a little sort of glimpse of the pearls of wisdom that it comes up with, isn't it? And, it is okay to eat, drink and be merry at times. Like that. So he's rebuking two things. He's rebuking out and out secularism, saying that's just a chasing after the wind. And the more you chase after it, the less and less you get satisfied. In the end, it's like a vapor. Everything just vaporizes. So if your goal in life are things that are just vapors, then your whole life is going to end up vaporized. But he's also a rebuke to those of us that say, oh, well, we shouldn't enjoy life at all. Don't find pleasure in anything. You accept it as a gift from God. And if you do it in reverence to God, then God does at least give us the capacity to enjoy these things and rejoice in them. But really only once we put them in the bigger context of life in him which comes from beyond the sun and beyond the grave, ultimately.
I haven't remembered which verses, but a few things made me think about certain situations where he's saying that things will happen to the righteous and the unrighteous. The wicked and the righteous will still have the same problems, the same travails. And it's a sort of a personal thing for me at the moment, because my daughter-in-law's mum has just been diagnosed with liver cancer. Mm-hmm. And she has a very strong faith and is a great evangelist. And I was sort of thinking about the whole situation and going through those questions, why her?
Mm-hmm.
Why, you know, she's a huge personality character in her church. She's, you know, a great mother, a great grandmother. And reading through just now, it made me think of that situation where it's saying that the righteous, the unrighteous will suffer the same.
Yes, there's also...
The verses, but...
Monica, I do think you have to remember as a Christian that you're never going to die. Mm. You may fall off this mortal coil, as they say,
yeah,
but you're going to live forever in Jesus. So, although these things happen to the righteous and the unrighteous, it's only the righteous that will live forever, isn't it?
You know? Mm.
Yeah, we do have that bigger perspective, which is, again, I mean, isn't it also, is it James that also says something similar, that God sends his sunshine on the righteous?
Yeah, yeah, it rains upon the righteous and the unrighteous.
And the rain as well. So, certain things don't match up in sort of divine fairness terms. Again, because everybody that thinks that God has to be fair here and now is still only looking within this life and this world.
Absolutely, yes, yes.
And they're going to be disappointed on that. But I like what you said about when you've got a real life problem that suddenly hits you, if you read what Koheleth wrote, you will get something out of it, even if it's only within his limitations. So it's worth, like in any piece of wisdom literature, approaching it in order to find out what is said about the issues that you've got, you come up against. But of course, you won't find the real answers until you get to the New Testament writings anyway. But that's one reason for pointing in the direction of this book, that, you know, whenever you come across it again and feel you want to read it, or... did you manage to get through it in half an hour?
Yes.
Yeah, just about.
Just about,
yeah. Just about, yeah.
But what you can do is you can even listen to the first bit of the recording again, and then you can have another read of it in your own time. And it might be at certain times of life you think, oh, let's just read what he says, knowing that he's going to have these limitations, and therefore moving on to the New Testament as well. But you might find, you know, it's in the Bible for a reason, and therefore God has sort of endorsed whatever he did, whoever he was and whatever he was writing about, as some means of helping us. He was a teacher who sought out the right words and gave us things to help us.
I find it one of my favourite books. I don't have that difficulty that people say.
Yeah, really. I don't find it depressing at all. I think it's incredible.
Yes.
Yes. Good.
It's he's a very reflective, deep thinker and phenomenal wisdom about and observations about life, and I love the way he concludes, and you know, I 100% agree with him about being under the sun, but we're not, as you say. So it reminds me all the time, I've been listening to Ray Comfort preaching and evangelizing, and you know, he takes this approach. He really grills people about their situation under the sun, gets them to realize the futility of their life. And then right at the end, he says, so are you going to do something about it?
And isn't that the true gospel, or at least the true approach to the gospel?
Seems.
Unlike what I hear a lot in various churches, where it's as though everything's really okay, but Jesus can make it a little bit better for you, or, you know, come and join the party.
Yes.
Life's life is a party, so come and join the right one, so to speak. But yeah, we need to be confronted with these things, otherwise you never find the real solutions. So
yes,
I find there's paradoxes though as well, because if you're thinking of him living and working within these limitations, he says things like in chapter 3, he has made everything beautiful in his time, and it's everything.
Yeah. You're right. He has these occasional glimpses that he shares with us to say, you know, they appear then contradictory. It's not unrelieved gloom and pessimism. It's as though he has been able to think it through a bit more. And, this world is meant to be beautiful, and there is a sort of beauty in it, and there are good things that happen. So we're still meant to sort of find those and live that way. He talks about it being a gift from God. Everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God.
He's one of the very first people in the Hebrew scriptures to talk about eternity. Life after death. So he was very much a forerunner of Yeshua.
And that's why it's wisdom literature, in one sense. It isn't just historical or whatever. It is, you say, the product of someone thinking things through and trying to help us to live life better. So, I think we're able to finish now. Did you like that sort of format of things? That
very introduction, much, do very something? Much, Paul.
Yeah.
So, now to get the washing up done and things like that. Good. Okay. Take some of the burden off me. So, we'll do it again, probably next week, but I promise you we'll be in the New Testament. It will be a letter. It will be one of the longer ones, so you won't have time necessarily to read it all. But I think, you know, we'll still, we have to do that. And we'll squeeze the reading in somehow and go on from there. So, okay, that should be next week then.
Okay. I'm going to stop the recording.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.